Hello, everyone. Hi, my name is Stuart Goldberg. I'm one of the leukemia doctors at the John Thor Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. For those of you not familiar with East Coast, I live in Manhattan, so it gives you an idea. We go across that bridge that Governor Christie blocked. And for the last, I guess, 10-plus years, I've run the MDS Foundation Centers of Excellence. So you heard a little about that. So there are numbers of hospitals across the country and actually across the world that have physicians who have had a specific interest in myelodysplasia, who do a number of, do research, have outreach programs, have other something that by meeting certain criteria, the MDS Foundation feels that we should be the sort of the advocates from the medical and scientific side. And in addition to this meeting, because we actually have this MDS Foundation meeting at our center every about 2 years or so, because it rotates around the country. The MDS Foundation also sponsors international meetings and has a big scientific meeting every other year that I've had the fortunate chance to speak at.
One year or more?
The international meetings are, well, they're every year, but they're like 1 year in Europe and 1 year in the United States. And it's more geared towards the physicians to try to at the sort of the cutting edge to try to help us understand the disease and exchange ideas on where we should move the field. So that's the professional level, right? And then I know we had a third world symposium I talked at once to try to educate physicians outside the country. There are also other sources of information. So the MDS Foundation, especially their website, is very nice to download. It has in multiple languages, which I always find helpful for my patients. There's also another organization, so the Aplastic Anemia MDS Foundation, that has similar booklets that you can look at. And certainly the Leukemia Society is sort of the big umbrella that does all of the blood disorders. And so all of these organizations have additional information. And I would... since unfortunately with myelodysplasia, it's sort of one of those common diseases that most doctors don't know very much about. And so I heard, comments earlier today, I switched my doctor and maybe the care I wasn't getting was up to the standards of what it should have been. And so we get that realization. And there's also a big problem in American medicine, and that is where do you go for your doctor? You go to somebody because a neighbor down the street told you that's where you go. We don't have that transparency of where to go for a lot of diseases, and especially when it's a rare disease like MDS, where nobody's heard of it. Unfortunately, since many people with MDS are very old and they're not the most vocal, political, it's you don't hear about the disease very much until a celebrity like Nora Ephron or another celebrity like Robin Roberts gets the disease. And then, you sort of hear about it as a blip, and then that's about it. So it's not a commonly talked about disease. The old name for it was pre-leukemia, which was abandoned more than 10 years ago, because fortunately, it doesn't evolve to leukemia in most individuals. And so we thought that was a bad name. But myelodysplasia doesn't really have a catchy ring, unfortunately. So it's one of those diseases that sort of goes under the radar. But is a fairly common disease. So you're actually not alone. I've heard you say you haven't met anybody. It's because most people don't know. It's not like there's a big advocacy that you would talk about. There's people here and there, but it's always sort of under the radar. And it's usually the one person sitting in the back getting the blood transfusion. And then, and often it's an older person in the back who's weak and tired and getting the blood transfusion in the back. And it's not the forefront of the, Hodgkin's disease, which everybody in this room I'm sure has heard about. Hodgkin's has much fewer patients, very few, 3,000 to 4,000 in the United States at any 1 year, whereas MDS maybe 10,000 to 40,000 gives you an idea. But who gets Hodgkin's disease? The teenager who's, once the teenager in the high school gets it, everybody in the town knows about it. But when the 80 or 90-year-old gets MDS and is, you know, sort of tucked away, we don't hear about it. So it's sort of one of those weird diseases. So let me just give you my take, and then later on I'm going to give a more formal presentation.
Do people maybe have it for a long time before they ever realize it or get diagnosed?
So MDS can be a very insidious disease. It doesn't come on all of a sudden. It is a, you know, it's in a group of diseases which we call the bone marrow failure disorders. So if you think about it, in your hip, you're making blood. And as you've heard, and I'll show you some other slides down the road, you've heard that blood has three main parts. There's the reds that give you the energy and the oxygen. So think of them as the trucks. They carry oxygen from your lungs to your muscles. If your muscles get fed, you can get up and walk. If your muscles don't get fed, you feel tired. And as that blood counts fall down, you feel more and more tired. Now, if you sit down and you're not moving, you may feel okay because your muscles don't need much. But as soon as you want to get in the high gear, then all of a sudden you feel more tired. And the development of how those factories slow down can occur over long periods of time. So to answer your question, there are people who have myelodysplasia and may not know it for many years. And actually, when they come to see us and we get their blood counts from the last, you know, can you have the family doctor send me, you know, your blood counts for the last year? We may have seen that red count in a man, 14 pints or a hemoglobin of 14, think of a gram of hemoglobin is about 1 pint of blood. So a normal healthy man has 14 pints of blood. A normal woman has about 12 pints of blood or a hemoglobin 12, hemoglobin 14. We may see that that went from 14 to 13 to 12 to 11 over the last 3 or 4 years before the doctor actually even said, uh-oh, now let me send him to a hematologist, a blood specialist, who also may be a cancer specialist. But before that is even picked up that there's a problem, and many times I'll even see patients and say, you may have MDS, but why should I bother sticking a needle in your hip? Because if I find it right now, you're still functioning, and I'm not even going to do anything for you for a while. So the question of when do you start, which we heard our last speaker talk about, is a very, very difficult and complex question. I mean, there's not a good answer for that. And you really have to look at what does the patient want to do? I have a very delightful gentleman and his wife that I've been taking care of for many years, and his blood counts were failing, and we've talked about therapy, and we talked about giving him blood transfusions, and he was getting low, and his wife said to him, you know, I want him to get some blood. He just sits in the bed all day and, you know, sits in the chair and watches TV, and he doesn't get up because he's so tired. And then she went out of the room, and as soon as he walked out of the room, he turned to me and said, Doc, don't bother with the blood transfusions. I'm happy in the chair. So, you know, I mean, but that I think really, you know, if he was a 55-year-old lawyer who I also take care of, I have to keep his hemoglobin up 12 or more. Why? Because he's competing with 35-year-olds who want his job. And if he can't stay up till 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night working, then he's not going to be at the peak performance. So whereas the 80-year-old who's happy sitting in a chair might let his hemoglobin drop to 8 or 9 pints when it should be 14, the 55-year-old tells me anytime he gets below 11, he feels tired and can't keep his activity up the level he needs to be functioning. So when do I start therapy? You could see it be very different between those. Okay? And when do I start to make even the diagnosis? It could, because this could have, you know, plugged, you know, slowly fell down over many years. When I meet a patient with MDS, typically it's because their red count's low. Usually it's because they're anemic. That's what the family doctor notices on the blood counts, that their red count has fallen. That's often the reason why the person went to the doctor in the first place, is they started feeling more tired. Occasionally you meet them because their platelets, and platelets, their job is to stop you from bleeding. They're the clotting cells. Occasionally it's because the platelets are low, and a normal platelet count's 150,000 or 150 on your sheet. Anything above 100, who cares? You know, it may be a little bit low, but, you know, you can go through an operation and you won't bleed. As it gets below 100, we start to see the risk of bleeding goes up. And it really starts to occur when you hit below 50. So often, even if it's above 50, as long as they're not, you know, don't play soccer and things like that, you know, we tell people don't do work. But once you get below 50, then we start seeing bruising and, you know, I banged myself, I got a big bruise. Once you get below 20, I got a bruise and I don't remember why. And unfortunately, if we get below 10, then people can start having internal bleeding, and that's where it's real dangerous. So that's where we actually will turn even to a 90-year-old and say, look, I know you don't want chemo, but at a platelet count that's that low, you may bleed and you may die from this disease, and we may need to do something even if you're 90 years old. And that's the discussion that we have to sometimes have. You know, so if the person's feeling fine and they're not, you know, not, you know, they get a blood transfusion, they feel okay. I don't know what the rest of your father-in-law's blood counts were. I mean, if he's feeling okay and his blood counts are still in the safe zone, then you're talking about some question of quality. But once your numbers get so low, then you do talk about quantity of life. And then that's the decision. We have to say, look, if you do this, we may change that course. So we go from a sometimes in the beginning of this disease, a quality disease, and unfortunately for some people, it becomes a quantity disease, but not fortunately for everybody. Okay? Third cell is the white cell, and you heard our last speaker talk a little about A and C, because the third cell that's in the is the white cell, and the white cell, its job is to fight infections. So a normal, healthy person has 5,000 white cells. We call them neutrophils or myeloid cells. That's why the A and C. Of the 5,000 white cells that I have, 4,000 are the neutrophils, and their job is to fight bacteria. They're the cells that keep you safe from today's infection. 1,000 of them are lymphocytes. And lymphocytes, their job is to make antibodies so you don't get the same infection twice. So that's what the vaccines work on. Okay? Now, in MDS, it's the neutrophils that fall apart, the bacteria-fighting cells. And when they get low, if out of my 5,000 white cells that I have, if 4,000 of them are neutrophils, I'm pretty good. If somebody coughs on me, I'm going to go okay. As that starts to fall down and they cough on me, I get more risk for infection. So that's why if we see it above 1.5, 1.5 or 1,500 neutrophils, that's probably enough white cells to keep us away from most infections. Once we get below that, all of a sudden the white cells are now, we don't have the bacteria-fighting cells and more infections. So in my patients with bad myelosplasia, they get an ear infection, followed by a sinus infection, followed by a urinary tract infection, followed by pneumonia. I mean, every time I'm seeing them, I'm writing a prescription for antibiotics. Once again, that would be one of those times when I twist somebody's arm and say, look, we can do the antibiotics over and over, but maybe we need to focus on treating the underlying disease. Okay. So there is a balance of when do you start. Some people we will start treatment just because we see the numbers before bad things have happened. And certainly in younger patients, we're going to be a little more proactive. In older patients where their decisions of should I do this or shouldn't I do this often are driven by are they down into danger zones or do they have cushion and they don't want to get therapy. So those are some of the questions about how you start and when you start. Why? That's always the next question I always get after I looked at the blood counts and say, you know, here's your blood counts. This is where you are in the spectrum of your blood. Then the natural question is why? And for there, I often will say, you know, talk to your clergyman. They're better at answering the why questions than a doctor. But there are some medical reasons why people get this disease. And this is really a disease of the environment. This is something, unfortunately, we've done to ourselves. This is chemicals, poisons, things like that. Being exposed to these type of things puts you at risk for developing damage to the bone marrow. So when I talk to a lot of my patients with myelodysplasia, and I ask them, you know, what did you do for a living? Oh, I worked in the gasoline petroleum industry. In New Jersey, we see a lot of that. Or my hobby is that I am a painter, and I have my thinners and all that stuff, the toluenes and the benzenes. So, you know, it can, and it's usually low levels of a poison for a long period of time. It's not somebody, oh, I walked in once to a painting gallery. No. But if you did painting or you worked with the photography and you have your black, you know, you develop your own prints and you do that every day for years, that's the type of people where the chemicals can start damaging the bone marrow. So what do I mean by damaging the bone marrow then? Well, so we see this person comes in, they have lower blood counts. We start sticking needles into hips. Why in the hips? Because if you think about where a dog bone, that's what your hips look like. They're hard on the outside, hard on the inside. There's a red core in the middle. That core is called the marrow, and that's where the factories are that make blood. Okay? When you were little, you made it in all your bones, but as we got older and our hips got big, these bones all become scarred, and you can't make blood there. And it's basically your backside and a little bit of the breastplate called the sternum. Okay? If there are some other diseases where you scar those things up called myelofibrosis, which can go along sometimes with myelodysplasia, where you scar that, the blood factories can actually go back to the spleen, which sits, I do that on this side, and the other, I know the spleen is in the upper left-hand corner, and that sometimes will get a little bit bigger in our myelodysplasia patients because that used to be where you made blood before you had bones when you were an embryo. So these are where you make your blood. So we stick a needle in your hip, and what we see is an ugly-looking bone marrow. Dysplasia means change. That's where the name comes from. Myelo is blood. Dysplasia is change. So what you're actually seeing is the factories themselves that make the blood are broken. And that's the disease. If I have a person who comes in with low blood counts and I stick a needle in their hip and the bone marrow looks completely normal and they're completely making, you know, the factories look all normal, this is not myelodysplasia. So by definition, you have to see the ugly-looking factories. And there's a whole bunch. John Bennett, who helped start this organization, is a pathologist. He looks on the microscope, and he's come up with other names when we get confused. The bone marrow looks good, yet the blood counts are bad, and we can't find some other vitamin problem. So often, probably many of you, when you're first diagnosed, the first thing the doctor did was they did an iron level and a B12 level and a folic acid level, maybe copper and zinc, because these are the vitamins you need to make blood. And worldwide, the most common reason to have low blood counts is iron deficiency. So, you know, but that's not what the problem here is. The problem isn't that you have a vitamin problem. The problem is that the factories, even if you gave them, if you gave the baker every little component, the factories to put it together are still broken. Okay? So that's the disease. The disease has to be made by the pathologist telling us that the factories are broken, leading to you having low blood counts. Which counts are low depends on, will then determine how you're going to feel, what's going to happen to you. And there are people who will just have low red counts and be tired. There are people who have low white counts and being infected. There are people who have low platelet counts and they'll be bleeding. And there's some people who get, unfortunately, two factories broken or all three factories broken. Most commonly, it's just the red. But there are people that have all three, and there are people who just have one, depending on which factory is broken. So far, catching? Okay. Next question is low grade and high grade. You heard that a little bit on the last speaker. So after somebody says, okay, doc, you gave me a name of what I got, and there are fancy names for it. Myelodysplasia is the grab bag name, and then the pathologist will look and say, well, the white cell factory looks ugly, but the red cell factory doesn't, and that's one name. And the image. So there'll be 10 or 15 different names. We now have them as five or six that are codified all the time. So you'll have some, if you get what's called the pathology report, and I agree completely with the last speaker, always ask, no matter where you are, you always want to get a copy of your path report. Put it in your file. It's, you know, because somebody's going to say down the road, grandchildren are going to say, didn't grandma have something? And you say, yeah, it was this kind of disease, and it was this type of subtype. Pathology report, just, you know, what they saw in the microscope. Nice to have it in your file. You may never look at it again, but just have that. And every doctor will be able to print that up for you. So I actually hand it out with every consult. Okay. Just one of those things that, you know, you want to just have that piece of paper. So that way you can look on the web and say, okay, this is what I have. This is the kind. Okay. But after the pathologist looks at it and gives his name, the next question the patients usually ask me is, so what does this mean? And really what they're asking is, am I going to live or die? Can you give me some idea on prognosis? You know, where's this headed? If I decide to do nothing, because that's, you know, you want to know, and you should have, and that's a question that, frankly, any doctor worth their salt should be willing to answer. Okay, so don't be afraid to ask your doctor, how am I doing? Am I on track? And what happens if I stop? And what happens if I get treatment? Because these are questions that you deserve the right, and if you deserve a straightforward answer. If you don't get a straightforward answer, tell the doc, look, I want a straightforward answer. I need to know. Now, you may not want that answer. You may want, not everybody has to run out to the doctor and ask that question. That's a decision. If you want to ask that question, the doctor should give you the answer. If you don't want to know, that's legal. That's allowed too. Okay, and we shouldn't, as doctors, force ourselves of what we think onto you. You should tell us, what do you want to know? But very typically, people at least want to know an idea of what's going on, where am I, especially when I'm first diagnosed. And so we use a couple different terms. Low grade and high grade is a nice split. So think of it, what is the disease? The low grade and high grade is it. The best way I think of myelodysplasia to describe it to somebody who doesn't know the disease, if you're going to have to tell somebody else, what do you got? It's a bone marrow factories are dying, and they're not producing blood anymore. So think about a garden. You got a garden that's so big, that big, okay? And in there you have factories, you have red plants and white plants and platelet plants that are making red cells, white cells, and platelets. And these factories are producing blood, producing the different types of blood, and giving you all the energy and all the clotting ability and all the infection fighting ability that you need. And then something damages one of those plants, or damages two of them, or damages all three. And gradually what happens is those plants start to shut down. And as they shut down, they produce less blood, right? They produce less fruit. So now the red count starts to drift down. That's low-grade myelodysplasia, where the factories are basically shutting down, and they shut down at this speed. And that speed is usually measured in years. So they will slow down, and that's why people can be diagnosed for many years and really not much happens. But slowly, if it gets low enough, it can bring people to somebody's doctor's attention. And it can go so low that it can actually cause people to die. I mean, if your platelet gets so low that you trip and fall and you bleed, that can be very dangerous. So just because it's low grade doesn't mean that it's not important. Especially, but we really typically think of low grade more as a quality issue. Because you're tired, you're more bleed, you're bruised, you're getting more infections until it gets really, really low. But then it still can stay low grade. And in 80% of people, that's how the disease goes. It just continues to fade away over time and over years to the point that, unfortunately, people do start to die from infections and bleeding. Yeah. Now, in about 20% of people, the disease changes to a high-grade disease. And it may have actually even presented earlier like that. What's high-grade disease? Well, you got your plants that are disintegrating slowly, and then all of a sudden a weed comes along. What's a weed do in a garden? A weed takes up energy, it takes up space, it takes all of it, the nutrients, and it even kills the plants. And the weed is what's called a blast. A blast is a leukemia cell. It's a factory that's so broken that all it does is take up space and energy. Now, most people never have that. Most people, it just fades, the disease, the bone marrow just sort of shuts down. But if those weeds come in there, well, then we worry about it. And so when we start seeing weeds, that's when we start using the word higher grade. If you have a few weeds, 5% or less, well, what does that do to your garden? Probably not much. So a low-grade disease, when many of us will call low-grade, if you have 5% or less leukemia weeds, 5% or less blasts. Because for the most part, how the energy is going to be and how the bleeding is going to be dominated by how the other plants are doing. But once you start to get more than 5% weeds in a garden, then all of a sudden they were taking nutrients. So somebody whose blood counts were slowly going down all of a sudden feel like they're going off a cliff. Because now it's not just the factories disintegrating, it's also the weeds starting to kill the other factories. And when does the whole factory fall apart? Over 20%. That's what leukemia is. the disease leukemia, if I see a person with leukemia, they've got all weeds and no plants. And so therefore, they're not, without plants, what's happening? They don't make blood. Their red counts fall to nothing. They need a blood transfusion every day. Their platelets fall to nothing. They're starting to bleed unless I give them a transfusion of platelets. Their white cells are so bad, they're getting infections. Now, so it's a dynamic between dying plants and emerging weeds. And which plant is broken, how many plants are broken, and how many weeds, and how fast the weeds decide to grow is what makes each of you different than the next one. Because there's not one size fits all here. There are some people that, like you, who have a broken red factory with a specific gene that's going to tell that gene, that factory to die at a certain speed. It's actually going to tell your platelet factories to overproduce. And so probably if you look at your original platelet counts, you probably had higher platelets than average because it overproduced, so you weren't at risk of bleeding. And there are other people in the room that probably had low platelets when they started. So each person's different based on which factories are broken, how many weeds, and what happens. And it changes over time, depending on which chemical, which poison, which genes decide to break in those factories. So that's the underlying disease. Now, to get more technical in it and to help the doctors really give you an idea and help us plan for our therapy, we've developed something called the International Prognostic Scoring System, or IPSS, and now we've revised it called the R-IPSS. And these are mathematical formulas by looking at thousands of patients and saying, okay, I have had 1,000 patients in my career, and these 800 did well, and these 200 didn't do well, and what was different about these people than that? So we've gone backwards and said, you know, if it had these, that was a bad thing, if they had this. So the IPSS, very simple. The simple version of it, before we get into the mathematical ones. And these are the type of things that make sense, right? One, if you have just your red factory broken, you're tired. But you're probably going to live a lot longer than if you have tired and you're bleeding. And if you're tired, bleeding, and infected, that's probably not as good. So the more factories that are broken, the more trouble you're possibly can get into, the worse your outcome. So when we developed an IPSS, we said, look, how many factories are broken? And the more factories are broken, the more worry we are about the patient. And that gets you points on the IPSS. Second, how many weeds you got? If you only have a few weeds, well, the garden's going to do better for a longer period of time. The more weeds you got, the more likely the whole factory's going to shut down, the more trouble somebody's going to get. So the second component of the IPSS is how many blasts? So how many factories are broken? How many blasts? And then the third is really the more scientific one, and that is genetics. We can now go into those bone marrow and look at the inside of the factory. Yeah, they're ugly on the outside, but what do they look like on the inside of the cell? If the cell's broken at the genetic level in the middle, well, that's going to give us a clue as to how fast it may disintegrate. Some genes, when they're broken, for example, chromosome 5, that one tells the red factory to break and to slow down at a very slow rate. And so actually people with 5q breaks tend to live a lot longer. Okay? And we actually will move them as not as worried. On the other hand, chromosome 7 is another chromosome that's frequently seen in MDS. When that one breaks, that one tells us that the whole factory is going to disintegrate over a course of 1 or 2 years. So we can see a disease where five is broken, we think of bone marrow disintegrating over 5 or 10 years. Where chromosome 7 is broken, we see a bone marrow that's going to disintegrate over 1 or 2 years. So we can use this information, how many broken factories, how many leukemia cells, and what are the genetics, to build a picture of, is this person somebody we should be very worried about, moderately worried about, or not too worried about at all. And so the IPSS gives the doctors and the patients some guess of where they're going to be. And that's the purpose of it. Okay? So those formulas are going to be on the app. You can look them up. I'm sure your doctor has calculated them. You can calculate them. And the question is, can you recalculate them? So when somebody has a bone marrow second every other year or something like that, do we recalculate? Yeah, we can use that and recalculate and say, okay, this is where they are currently are. Now, the scary part about the IPSS, they actually talk about survival, how many years people live with that disease once they have these things happen. One important thing to know about the IPSS, though, is that is what's called natural history, in other words, no treatment. We designed the scoring system to say what happens if we diagnose somebody and then they step away. Now, by no treatment, I don't mean no treatment at all. That we give them blood transfusions and some basic antibiotics. Okay, but if we don't intervene with any pills or chemo or IVs or things like that, and we just let the disease progress at the speed it's going to progress at, what could we expect? Okay, so that's how they developed the IPSS, because that gives us an idea of where this person is. Hopefully, with intervening, we change that curve. We change that course. But the scoring system was developed to be what would happen if we don't do anything about it. Okay? So that gives you an idea of what the disease is, why it's important, because how many blood factories are going to give you different symptoms, and how we prognosed it. Okay? Questions about any of that so far? Okay. How do we treat it? Okay. And then I'm going to talk about something different after the break, So, question of treatment becomes, what do you want to accomplish? And so this is actually one of those rare diseases where when I have a patient with MDS, when I have an acute leukemia patient, I'm actually a bone marrow transplant doctor too. That's what my original training was in. What do you want to accomplish? And that's not an easy question. Are you trying to cure somebody so that they can have another 40 years like Robin Roberts? She's young. She's got this disease. She had high-risk disease, by the way. She had a monosomy 7. I mean, I actually know her because I know her doctor. she's from New York, by the way, my hometown. do somebody have a very bad, ugly disease, IPSS high grade or high risk, where if we don't do anything, they're going to decline very quickly? Well, then we might want to intervene with something a little more aggressive. If somebody has a very low-grade disease, a 5Q-, where they're not having much symptoms, the counts aren't even that bad, we say, look, even if we don't do anything, they're going to coast for many years, well, maybe we aren't as aggressive. And so we have to put in how old are they, what do they want to accomplish in their lives, how close are they to diabetes and heart attacks and all that stuff happening, that maybe we're not the most important doctor. Maybe it's the heart doctor is the most important. So you have to balance the whole thing. And then what do they want to do? Is he happy sitting in a chair? or does he have to run up the stairs to compete with the other lawyers? So the decision of what you do depends on what you want to accomplish. So you have to talk to your doctors and nurses and say, what do I want out of life? Depending on what you want out of life and where you are in your life, it may be very different. For many people, in the beginning of the disease, when it's lower grade, when it hasn't advanced very much, and mostly it's anemia, tiredness, it's a matter of giving them blood transfusions and getting that energy back up. And then when the energy is back up, how do we keep it up? And so the most common therapies in the United States are blood transfusions and then some type of fertilizer, growth factor. The growth factors we typically use are some drugs called Procrit or Aranesp. What are they? They're actually chemicals that are made naturally by our kidneys. It's our kidneys' job to tell us to make blood, by the way. If I cut myself and bleed a pint on the floor, how does my body know that I'm down a pint? Well, the kidneys know that I'm processing 14 pints of blood every hour, and if all of a sudden Dr. Goldberg bled a pint on the floor, the kidneys will say, hey, I'm underworking. It'll send the signal to the bone marrow, make more blood. So when I was a fellow back in the 80s, they actually had discovered that this chemical called EPO was made by the kidneys, and if you bottled it up and genetically engineered it and give people a shot of EPO, you basically are putting fertilizer down that tells the body to make more reds. So how do you fix a plant that's dying? Well, maybe you squeeze a little bit more blood out of it by giving a little more fertilizer. Does it fix the plant? No. But does it squeeze a little more drops of blood out of it? Yeah. You can get a dying plant to give you a little more fruit by putting some more fertilizer down. There are two of them on the market, Procreate and Aranesp. And as you heard, the MDS Foundation helped keep those drugs on the market. There were some problems. If you give those medications to people with breast cancer or colon cancer, yeah, you make them feel better while they're getting the treatment, but it also makes the cancer, it's a fertilizer, so it makes those cancers get worse. Okay? And there were some economic problems. The feds actually... But the bottom line is that those are there. Okay? There are experimental Procrit-type drugs that are coming out. We may actually have a new one next year. So there are other ones in that type of family. Okay? There's also a drug called Neupogen or Neulasta or Leukine. These are fertilizers for whites. So if somebody has a very low white count, you can actually give a fertilizer and get the white cells. Now, the MDS Foundation actually does have in their booklets that they don't recommend on a routine basis to give those every day or every, because they're very short-acting, the white ones. The red ones, very common to use. We fought for it, and we give that and try to keep the blood counts up and prevent you from needing transfusions. Okay? But the white ones, they work, and then 2 days later, they're stopped. So typically, we tend to reserve those for persons who are in the hospital with an infection, because they're very expensive, and using them chronically gets the white count up, but you could probably do that better with just giving an antibiotic here and there. So there's other ways to get around that. But some doctors will use intermittently the white cell fertilizer just to keep people tweaked. There's a little style. There's a lot of disagreement in the field. If your doctor's doing it, I'm not going to fight. Okay? I mean, there are things that are disagreements in the field. And there's probably some literature supporting my view, but I'm always right. That's the way. Unfortunately, we don't have great fertilizers for platelets. There have been a couple that have been out there. There are drugs that are being used to help platelets go up. They've had some starts and stops in the MDS world. We do have them actually for other diseases. In MDS, it's been a little bit more tricky. Especially in Houston, they are big advocates of one of them for certain, and they actually have done some research in one of the drugs to help platelets during chemotherapy, and I actually participated in those trials. But that's one where I will tell you there that we don't have a pat answer. Okay, but the fertilizer for red, pretty much out there for all the time. The fertilizers for whites, intermittently if you need them because you're sick with infections. Okay, and that's usually where we start. Now, as the disease progresses and more blood transfusions occur, we get into problems with the complications of transfusions, which I'm going to talk about next. That was what I actually was invited to talk about, but we were ahead of schedule, so they yanked me to talk a little more. Okay. Then, at a certain point, though, all the fertilizers in the world aren't going to save a dying plant. So at a certain point, you may want to actually try to work on the plant itself. And that's where we talk about chemotherapy. And yes, I am a cancer doctor in addition to being a blood doctor. Okay? Chemotherapies, though, can come in all shapes and forms. And the chemos that we're going to use to treat myelodysplasia are not there to design to kill the cells. They're there designed to make them to work better. Okay? And there are three FDA-approved drugs. Lenalidomide, also known as Revlimid. It's a knockoff of an old medicine called thalidomide. Remember thalidomide from the 1950s where the babies were born without arms? But it turned out that the blood counts actually ran up in the women who were pregnant. And they actually noticed that, and years later, they came up with a whole set of ways to use lenalidomide or Revlimid. Okay? The reason you have to fill out tons of paperwork every month, because the child advocacy groups, you figure, never wanted that drug to see the light of day. So in an agreement with the FDA, they said, look, we know this drug is horrible when it comes to causing birth defects. But if we make sure that it never gets in the hands of a pregnant woman, then it may have its benefits. So that's why there's tons of paperwork. And believe me, the tons of paperwork you're doing now are nothing what you had like when I had to do us back in the 80s. We had a patient one of my patients snuck it in from Germany, you know, thalidomide, because to treat his disease before it was available in the United States. So that's what lenalidomide is a pill that basically tells the red factories to start growing. It doesn't do too much for the whites of the platelets. It may have some effect. But when they did the original testing, they found it didn't work on everybody with MDS. But if somebody had a chromosome 5 break, it could be dramatic. 2 out of every 3 people who took that medicine, all of a sudden the blood counts would get better. And the blood counts would stay better for a long period of time. If you didn't have chromosome 5, it could make it go up, but not as frequently. And so the FDA said, you know what? That's really not the indication. Doesn't mean the doctor off-label can't use it. And certainly I've written many, many times off-label for lenalidomide or Revlimid to treat patients who have low red counts. And there are randomized clinical trials, a big one that's going to be presented in a couple of weeks at the ASCO meetings, trying to get that drug on the market for those patients also so they don't have, doctors doesn't have to do it. I know because I'm the co-author. So it's an international study to get this drug, mostly in Europe because Europeans can't get it. But lenalidomide helps the reds go up. It doesn't do much for the whites and platelets. But it's often a first step for somebody who just has low reds. The other two drugs that are on the market are Vidaza and Dacogen, are the brand names, or azacitidine and decitabine. And these are weird type of chemos. They're given 1 week per month. And how long is a week depends on where you live. In New Jersey, I don't like to work on weekends. It's 5 days a month. In Cleveland, in the Cleveland Clinic, they like to work on Saturdays, but they don't work on Sundays. So a lot of theirs are 6 days a week. And if you go across the street into New York City at Cornell, they believe in 7 days a week. So, because they have fellows who work on the weekends. Not the big attendings, don't come in. So there's arguments you can see. But 1 week a month. And what these drugs do, they're given either through an IV or given through as a shot. These are weird kind of chemotherapies because they can stimulate a plant and kill a weed. They do both. The mechanism is actually starting to be understood in that they glop onto the genes, and if a little bit glops on, they stimulate the cell, but if a lot glops on, they kill the cell. And blasts have a lot of genetic problems, so therefore a lot of that glops onto the blast gets killed. So it kills the weed while it stimulates the plant. Okay? So in a person with a higher grade disease where the weeds are starting to take over, these are a type of medications that can kill off those weeds and stimulate the plants. Okay? And so in a classic study called AZA-001, which is actually described in the MDS book that you probably have, that I think you were giving out, this was a big international randomized trial where half the people got just transfusions and half the people were given 1 week a month Vidaza or 5-azacitidine for people who had higher grade myelodysplasia. So you're not going to give it to somebody who just has low red counts and no blasts. But if they have multiple blood counts that are broken, starting to bleed and bruise, if they have lots of leukemia cells where we say, the weeds may take over the garden, half the people got the Vidaza. Half the people got the blood transfusions. The bottom line is more people were living who got the Vidaza than who got the blood transfusions. It stimulated the blood. It kept the leukemia cells from taking over, and it improved survival. And what was the cost? Well, guess what? When they asked quality of life questions, the people who got the chemo said that they felt better than the people who got the blood transfusions. So for you with your 90-year-old, this may be the type of questions that you need to ask the doctor. Now, there are other things that are going on you got to ask, but it's, you know, people think of chemo and they say they get worse. Well, having low blood counts and being tired all the time doesn't make you feel so good. And if you can get those plants to start functioning, the energy level can go up and the bleeding can disappear and the infections go away. And then in the long run, the quality may actually get better. So there may be a little dip. And if you saw that slide there, the first 2 or 3 months, when you come in with a weed killer, what's going to happen? You're going to have an empty field. So the blood counts get worse the first 2 or 3 months. And people do feel worse the first 2 or 3 months. But then the healthy plants start to come back in, and the energy level gets better. So when I have somebody who's on the edge, I tell them, look, if you're willing to suffer, and I don't mean suffer, but if you're willing to put through a couple months of feeling a little bit worse, in the long run, you're going to feel better. Now, some people say, look, I don't want to feel worse, and you know, I don't need that extra energy, and my blood counts aren't that bad, and I don't have that many leukemia cells, then maybe I don't want to do that. So there are people that I say, on the scorecard, you look like you should get it. And when we talk to them, they say, maybe this isn't the right fit. Okay? And the other thing you saw on that slide was it takes 4 to 6 months for these things to kick in. So the biggest error and biggest disappointment I see when I do second and third opinions is when somebody's gotten one cycle, they feel lousy, and they stop. And then they often will, like a month or two later, come to see me for a second opinion. I say, look, you started and you got all the downside and didn't stay with it long enough to get the upside. So once you commit to this, you have to commit for at least 4 to 6 months. And my friend from Cleveland Clinic, who's one of the world's experts in MDS, his comment was when patients ask, how am I doing? He sticks his head in the sand and says, I won't answer your question until 6 months from now. And at 6 months, then I'll give you an answer. Because I can make him feel worse the first couple months as I'm trying to make you feel better. And in the long run, we know in the randomized trials where half people got it, the people did say it was worth it. And we're talking about 75, 85, 90-year-old people. Okay? But that doesn't mean it's right for everybody. Okay? And finally, and I'll stop because I don't know where my time. Is there a cure for this disease? And what do we do for the young person who doesn't have the weird 5Q? You're in a minority, by the way. Okay? Which is good. You're in a good minority. But what do we do for the younger person who says, look, I want to be cured? And younger is technicals. You know, we've done into the 80s, by the way, for bone marrow transplants at our center. Okay? When I started, anything over 45 was old. I wouldn't... So, my first transplants back in the 80s, we wouldn't touch anybody really over 40. And now we're thinking routinely up into the 80s, if they're an 80 who walks and talks and feels energy and can do things and has to have a good heart and a good lungs and good things like that. Okay? And so monitoring blood counts and looking at kidneys and liver and all that stuff, important to do probably with these drugs. Any of these drugs every couple months at least. Okay, so I agree with you. You know, you've got to tweak your doctor. You make sure that they're following just not the blood, that they're following other things, which I'm sure they do. That's pretty common. Often you can't tell what other orders we send. But we can cure this disease. But the cure comes with a lot of price, and that is a bone marrow transplant. 10 seconds of what a bone marrow transplant is by a guy who actually does them. So that's always, you know, I hear family doctors tell the family, oh, you don't want this because you don't, or cancer doctors will give all kinds of crazy numbers because they don't do it. I do it, okay? I've been doing them for 30 years. What we do in a bone marrow transplant in myelodysplasia today is very different than what I did when I wasn't going to treat anybody over the age of 40. Most people now get what's called a mini transplant. That's a misnomer. Mini means mini to me compared to what I used to do, not what the patients feel. A mini transplant is a month in the hospital and a year of their life. If I say that, then that's enough to really, at that point. What happens in that first week is we give them poison, and now I am talking about chemotherapy. If you want to fix the field and you got broken plants, you got to burn them down. So people come in the hospital in that first week, we destroy the whole bone marrow. Good, bad, anything, wipe it down to F garden that has no plants left. Now, what I mean by mini, we've learned that we don't have to hit them as hard to wipe it down. That's the difference. So we've given less chemotherapy, but at the end of the week, the bone marrow is pretty much dead. We then turn to a donor, a brother or sister, an unrelated person who happens to have the same bone marrow type that you, called HLA typing. Now we can actually even do half children, children who are going to only be half of you. Much more risky, but we can do that routinely. Twin, by the way, no good. Throw away your twin. Well, be nice to her, but... Absolutely no. Not even a question. If it's an identical twin. Identical twin will not work. 80%, 90% relapse rate. Not even worth doing it. Okay? So, I mean, that we could... So get rid of that. I'll explain. Okay? So what we do is we destroy the bone marrow, turn to our donor, take out blood from them. Remember I said blood, that's called a stem cell transplant. Or we can take out bone marrow from their hip. That's called a bone marrow transplant. So the only name difference, because you'll say, well, what I talk about, you know, I go through a whole consult with a person and talk all about bone marrow transplant. So, well, what about this thing called a stem cell transplant? Well, the difference between bone marrow transplant and stem cell transplant is, what do I do to the donor? Do I take it from their blood or do I take it from their hips? For you, it's the same thing. It's the same chemo. Take those seeds out, put them into the arm, they float around, they land in the hip. It's like throwing seeds in the air. When they hit the ground, they start growing. Cancer up here, I give chemotherapy, they go to nothing. I squirt in seeds, wait. A month later, they grow back. That's why you're in the hospital for a month. During, when the old bone marrow is dead, the new one hasn't grown back, you're a sitting duck. So you're sitting in the hospital, blood transfusions every day, antibiotics every day, watch for infections, stay in a little bubble. A lot of care to keep you alive, essentially. Believe it or not, we're actually pretty good at doing that. Get most people through the transplant. The danger of the transplant is when the counts come up and everybody's happy. Because when those seeds grow back, they're not you. You now have somebody else living in your hip. So rejection. So over the next year, you're seeing the doctors every single week, sometimes every month if you're really doing well, till we get that new bone marrow to like living in his new hip. So somebody asked, do I have to be on medicines if I change to a transplant? The answer is yes. You're not on medicines anymore for MDS. You're in medicines to keep that bone marrow happy. Because that bone marrow doesn't want to live in you. My white cells, my immune system is there to keep me free of infection. Somebody calls to me, that germ looks different than me. Different things don't like me, don't like me, and I don't like different things in my body. My immune system will kill it. If I put your white cells in my body, and now your white cells are floating around, they will see my body is different. And they will attack my body. That's called graft versus host. So it's the new immune system attacking the whole body. And so we got to keep that bone marrow happy in there. Now, fortunately, in many people, that bone marrow will learn about its new home. And once it learns about its new home, we can then get rid of the medicines. So about 70% of people at the end of a year are off rejection medicines because now the bone marrow has learned. But there are a significant number of people that it takes 2 or 3 or 4 years or may never be happy in there. And in MDS, unfortunately, about 1/3 of patients will die during that first year from a transplant. It's a pretty high number. Now, most people with MDS are over the age of 65, and so we are talking about older patients having bone marrow transplants. But the national number is right now about 1/3 of patients. We will cure about 1/3 of patients. About 1/3 of patients will die from the MDS. In other words, we didn't get rid of every last plant, and they came back. And about 1/3 of patients will die from the transplant. So 1/3. For a patient who's in their 60s, early 70s, who has a bad type of MDS, it may be worth it. If I have a person who's walking in here, now they have a lot of blasts, they're bleeding all the time, they're in the clinic all day getting blood transfusions, and as soon as I'm done, they're back there the next day. And you say, look, this is not a life. They may say a 1/3 chance of dying is worth it. For a person who has normal blood counts and maybe on a little rev limit and doing fine, that kind of risk is probably not there. So when's the right time to move to transplant? Depends on how bad the disease is. It's not the last resort. I have seen many consults in my lifetime that the first treatment was a bone marrow transplant. For Robin Roberts, the first treatment was a transplant. Not because she was young. She had bad MDS. She had breast cancer years before. The poisons from the breast cancer poisoned her bone marrow. She had leukemia blasts. If they didn't burn that marrow down, she was going to get in trouble real fast. So they put her on Vidaza or Dacogen. Actually, she got Dacogen. She's been open on her study, so she got a couple months of that 5-day, 1 week a month to get things under control. and basically to give them long enough to get the donor ready, and then came in and did the whole thing. For her, the risk was worth it, because if she didn't do this, her bone marrow was going to fail very quickly. I could have another young person who's doing wonderfully on a drug, or the blood counts aren't that bad. It may not be the time to do it. So when is a transplant appropriate? It's when the risk of the transplant is less than the risk of the disease. For most people, that's at intermediate 2. So there have been some studies looking at, if you have somebody who's brand new with an IPSS, low risk, well, the disease is not so bad, the transplant's dangerous. IPSS high, the disease is probably out of control, and the transplant may not work. So if we have low, intermediate one, intermediate two, and high, intermediate 2 seems to be the break point. But that's on populations. Then again, you have to talk to the person, how good a donor they have, how healthy they are, where does the risk fall? That's not an easy discussion. That's one that somebody who knows transplant. So one of the few recommendations I will give you is anybody who's young, don't listen to your cancer doctor on whether it's time to have a transplant or not. Talk to the transplanter and tell him and ask when's the right time. Because oncologists, even oncologists in my area, who've been working with me for years, don't know the right timing. Okay, so you need to have your oncologist who's taking care of you, and then the transplanter who actually says, this is what I do for a living, I'll tell you if this is the right time for you. Because the oncologist may have not understand what's happened in the field. So this is where you do need two doctors who will talk to each other. Okay, and so obviously with, you know, young and doing well, you want to every so once in a while check in with the transplant doc, say, hey, anything new, where am I, this is where I am, you know, and they'll probably say no, but that's okay. But it's worth it, because you don't want to miss the opportunity when the time was right. Okay. Why not a twin? Because the reason a transplant actually works is when you put the new seeds in, they actually, not only do they fight the skin, the rest of your body, they also fight the weeds. So they will actually kill off, you know, you have two plants in there now. You have your old cancerous ones, and you've got the brand new seeds. And those new seeds will say, look, I want to take over the field. And the fact that they actually will fight to take over the field is what actually cures the patients. It's not the poisons I gave up up front. It's the new bone marrow. Twin, their cells will be perfectly happy in there, right next to the cancer cell, and the cancer cell will come back. So the relapse rate, yes, it's much safer. You don't get graft versus host disease, but you also relapse. So for certain diseases, we don't do twins. Myelodysplasia is one of them. Acute leukemia is one. Chronic myeloid leukemia is one. For lymphoma, great disease to do a twin. So it's not that we never use twins, but there are certain diseases where you need that fighting, and that was why we wouldn't pick a twin. Of developing MDS? It's mostly environmental. It's mostly environmental, so it's probably a little bit higher than the background, but it's probably... Now, in concordant studies, there is higher, but that's because they probably lived in the same place and therefore exposed to the same chemicals. No, because it's not... The deletion 5 happened after. Okay. You weren't born with the deletion 5. Okay? Questions about the disease? And then I'm going to switch to something else after somebody else.
Since she started the Revlimid, her white count has dropped drastically, and her neutrophils is that just the Revlimid?
So the Revlimid itself will actually push down the white cells, and it will push down a little bit on the platelets. Yeah.
It pushes the platelets, but her neutrophils are really...
Yeah, that's
okay, I think.
And so then we often will back off on the dose, because it is a problem of the drug. However, and here's the however, and I don't want to scare you, the scare part, is that that could also be the underlying disease. So that's, if we see that every once in a while, we actually will do a marrow just to make sure it is the drug and not the disease. But for most people, it is the drug. And then it's just a matter of, you know, lessening the dose or going to every other day. I mean, so you play with the dose to try to find that happy balance. But that is a side effect of the drug. Okay? I'll be back in a few seconds. That's some legal things I have to study. Goodbye.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg.